I'm Dr. Tess Laurie. I'm a medical doctor and a researcher. I have a medical degree and a PhD from the University of the Witwatersrand in South Africa. And for the last 9 years, I have been running a company called the Evidence-Based Medicine Consultancy in Bath in the United Kingdom. At EBMC, we support clinical practice guidelines by providing evidence to organizations such as the World Health Organization and also the NHS through our systematic reviews so that they can make recommendations on clinical practices for doctors to use in their surgeries.
Could you just tell us about your medical background too?
Yeah, so I practiced clinical medicine and obstetrics and gynecology in South Africa. When I moved to the UK in 2009, I started doing a bit more. I did work in contraception and sexual health, but then my research practice took over, and I've basically been doing research since then. I don't do any clinical work now at all. I only do research work.
So why is it that there's something such as a evidence-based medical consultancy is even necessary? Surely all decisions that practitioners and also regulators and policymakers make must be based on evidence. So in theory, we shouldn't need people like you, Tess.
Well, not really, because if you consider the huge body of evidence, you know, there's hundreds of medical papers being published every day, and all of the evidence that comes from these papers has to be what we call synthesized. So, you know, on a particular intervention, you have to have, resources to search all the list of studies on the intervention and then to evaluate the studies, to pool the studies together to do what's called a meta-analysis, and then to actually come up with a conclusion as to whether whether there's enough evidence on something or not. So a lot of these organizations employ people like me or companies like mine as external consultants, because either they don't have the capacity within them, or it's a structure that suits them to hire in companies like mine to do this work for them.
Now, one of the things we do hear quite a lot is that these days, and I'm talking about probably over the last 20 or 30 years, much of the research is funded by drug companies themselves, and that they obviously have a vested interest in the outcome and also about whether or not they're going to release the full details to the public. How easy is it for somebody like you to get a full spectrum of the research that's available on a particular topic, and also how trustworthy it is?
You know, this has been an increasing problem over the years. I have noticed, especially a lot of the work that I do is in cancer research and evidence synthesis, and it can be very difficult to get the full picture of adverse events from pharmaceutical companies. And I think primarily because, you know, they hold the data, and one can never be sure that the paper is completely transparent, because obviously there's a lot of interest in getting medicines approved and presenting the data in the best way possible. So it is an ongoing issue, and I think it's something we probably need to look at very closely going forward, especially in the COVID context, with all these new drugs that are being developed very quickly.
Okay, so if you're getting a report on a particular drug and its effects, etc., or whatever it is you're looking at, surely that isn't really worth very much if you're not allowed to look at the data, the original data, which it's compiled from.
Well, not all studies are pharmaceutical studies. I mean, it depends on what sort of intervention you're talking about. I mean, certainly ivermectin, for example, there's not none of those studies are pharmaceutical industry studies. They're all studies done by doctors. because ivermectin is a generic medicine and nobody can make any money of it. It's basically can be manufactured anywhere around the world for very little. It's about 3 cents a tablet in some countries. So this is the reason why ivermectin is not really, there's not really much interest in studying its efficacy because against COVID is because no one can make any money from it. But fortunately, there are at least 24 studies, randomized controlled trials, that have been conducted on ivermectin in low and middle income countries, because this is where the medicine has been used for the last 40 years against parasitic diseases. So the studies from these countries have been conducted by doctors who have, they're not only looking after patients with COVID, but they've actually found the time to do the research as well so that they can help us in high-income countries to find a treatment for COVID.
Okay, so what first brought your attention to this ivermectin drug? What was it that initially made you think, well, this is worth looking at? And maybe you, I don't want to put words into your mind or your mouth, but why hasn't this been looked at before?
Well, in actual fact, it has been looked at before, but for some reason, there's a bit of a blackout on the press with regard to ivermectin. Ivermectin has been studied since May last year, and in some countries like Peru, they've been using it. In India, they've been using it as well. There are many countries in the world, particularly South America and other countries, where their options at the beginning of the pandemic, you know, where they basically realized they'd never be able to afford monoclonal antibodies. So they looked at what they had and they thought, well, can we use any of these treatments that we use for other diseases like malaria and worms? So ivermectin has been, it's on the World Health Organization list of essential medicines for scabies and worms and other parasitic conditions. So doctors in those countries have been using it. They know that it's incredibly safe because it's already been given, 4 billion doses have been given.
Well, it's safe, yes, but surely most doctors are not going to think, well, hey, this is a great cure for this respiratory disease. It's not.
You'd be surprised, doctors do. When you, as a doctor, and you're working in a resource-poor setting, and you think, well, these are my tools, this is what I have to work with. Let's give it a try. You know that it's extremely safe. You give it a try and it works. Well, then you're going to keep using it. That's how doctors have practiced for many, many years. So, it's all very well saying, I don't know what you said. You said doctors wouldn't use it.
Well, I think it's counterintuitive, isn't it, that an anti-parasitic drug is going to be any use for a respiratory disease?
Well, it's not counterintuitive. And certainly what they have discovered now, and there's several studies that show that it's a potent antiviral and an anti-inflammatory. So there's so much reason for it to work against COVID, all stages of the disease. It works as a preventive, and it works mild, moderate, and severe disease, because in severe disease you have an inflammation which causes the illness and the deterioration of respiratory function. And so ivermectin works against that stage as well. Obviously better if it's early on, when it can work against the viral stage. But there's certainly plenty of evidence to show a mechanism of action against viruses. And there's even, it's not only against COVID. It's has shown activity against dengue and Zika and HIV and various other viruses. So it's a very exciting area of research.
Well, it certainly sounds it. Now, what are these? I mean, I know I don't want you to go through all of the studies, but can you give us just a sort of taster of what these studies have found out about ivermectin and when to use it and how effective it is?
Well, the highest form of scientific evidence in terms of assessing whether something works or not, a treatment works, is called a systematic review and meta-analysis. Now, this is my specialty. You know, a doctor will struggle to make a decision on a single medical paper because there are so many papers on a particular intervention. And some will say the thing works, some will say it doesn't, some will say it's very effective. And it can be very confusing if you if you don't see the big picture in terms of what's called a meta-analysis. Now, meta-analysis is the pooling of data from different trials. So you wouldn't just look at one trial. You take all the trials on a comparison. Now, what we did is we compared ivermectin versus no ivermectin. And we found, in our initial review, we found 21 trials, three of them were on prevention, and the others, the 18, were on the treatment of COVID. So we took those trials, we pooled the data where we could and where it made sense to do so, and we found a 68% reduction in deaths across these trials. So there was an average of a 68% reduction in deaths if people got ivermectin. And what this meant in absolute terms was that 2.5% of people in the ivermectin group died, but 10%, or it was 9%, in the control group died, so they didn't get ivermectin. So, and this meant across our analyses that for every 16 people you treat, you save one life with ivermectin. When it's given as prevention, we found, as I say, three studies. And across these three studies, it showed that ivermectin prevented COVID infection by around 86%. So these studies were conducted in healthcare workers and in family contacts of COVID. And we found a 5% infection rate with ivermectin and a nearly 30% infection rate if you didn't get ivermectin. So based on this evidence, we concluded that ivermectin is probably a very useful medicine for doctors to have in their toolkit at this stage of a pandemic.
Okay, so have doctors been using it and prescribing it here in the UK?
Well, unfortunately, in the UK, it's not licensed for use. There are other countries, for example, France and Germany and I think Holland, they have ivermectin on their medical, in their formulary, whereas in the UK, doctors can prescribe it for example, if you can prescribe it, it's quite confusing really, but you can prescribe ivermectin for an immunocompromised person with COVID because you want to protect them from getting worms, but you can't prescribe ivermectin against COVID, according to the current state of affairs. So we do have ivermectin in the country, but certainly not in the quantities we would need to treat our patients in hospital with COVID.
Well, hang on, Tess. This sounds absolutely absurd. Something which is proven to be very effective. You've got to pretend you're treating someone for something completely different if you want to use it as a doctor.
It is absurd. It's completely absurd. And I can't tell you, you know, when I first started work on this, as I say, I started work, it was actually just between the Christmas and New Year, it was my holiday. And I thought, well, I saw this and I thought, well, maybe I can assess this evidence and just see if it works or not. And then I found out that it did work. And so on the 4th of January, I sent urgent messages to Matt Hancock, to the Shadow Health Secretary, and also to my Ministers of Parliament and so on. And I got no response. And so on the 6th of January, some of the listeners might have heard this, but I actually put a video on YouTube just asking the Prime Minister to please contact me because I needed to discuss this matter of ivermectin, and I had no response. But I had some response from members of the public and also health professionals saying, you know, how could we get the message out? So we've since done, you know, I had never thought it would take me so long to communicate good news like this to the health department, but it's now been more than 3 months, 3.5 months. There are a number of doctors who want to prescribe it. There are some doctors who are prescribing and are very and are seeing benefits for their patients, but people are afraid. Doctors are afraid to prescribe, and they're afraid to talk about it because There's such misinformation about ivermectin because it is such a threat to the pharmaceutical industry. Because it's so cheap.
Surely the pharmaceutical industry, like everybody else, wants to see people get better. I mean, why should it be a threat to them?
I can't speak for them. But all I can see is as soon as there's a new medicine, even if it's early stage, a phase one in the newspaper, there's a lot about it saying this is a wonderful medicine that's going to be given as a pill, an early stage COVID. And it's just totally absurd because there is a pill already for early stage COVID that works extremely well. And there's no need for novel treatment. So all I can really talk about is what I see, and what I see is huge amounts of misinformation on ivermectin. There's a lot of misinformation saying there's concern about safety when it's probably one of the safest medicines on the planet, having been used so widely for decades with billions of doses and very few adverse events reported.
Okay, well now is your chance to scotch those rumours. That's one thing that you've said is not true. Are there any other stories that have been spread about ivermectin that you'd like to put straight?
Yes, there are. One very popular story by the authorities is to say that it's a veterinary medicine. Now, it is used by vets to treat worms and animals, but it's been used in humans for the last 40 years. And it's still used in humans. In fact, currently on the planet, there will be millions of people using ivermectin, both for COVID and for worms and for scabies. And in actual fact, it's commonly used in nursing homes because it helps with scabies outbreaks in nursing homes around the world. So it's used in lots of institutional settings to prevent scabies, so to prevent and treat. So, it is a useful veterinary medicine. But it's a very useful human medicine, and in fact, its developers won the Nobel Prize for Medicine in 2015, some decades after it was first developed, because of its unbelievable impact that it's had on humanity, on the health of humanity around the world. So, yes, I'd like to scotch that. It is not just a veterinary medicine.
On a practical level, there's two things I'd like to ask you. One is if people would like to get treated with ivermectin or get their loved ones treated with it, what they should do, and secondly, how they can help you banging your fist against the door of Matt Hancock and getting them to listen.
Yeah, so what we need, basically, for one person to get ivermectin, we all have to get ivermectin. We all have to have access. We don't have it available in this country at the moment. What we need to do is we need to together demand access to this life-saving treatment and make sure that our GPs know about it, because our doctors are unfortunately too busy to be able to evaluate the evidence themselves. So we need to make them aware that there's evidence on ivermectin that they can access. They can access it on my website, ebmc.co.uk, but also on the BIRD website. BIRD stands for the British Ivermectin Recommendation Development, and it's a group that we put together. It's actually an international group of health professionals trying to get ivermectin approved for use across the world. Particularly, the developing world seems to be more resistant to hearing about ivermectin. So, it's a BIRD website. Birdgroup.org, and also ebmc.co.uk, and so we have all the work we're doing at the moment is crowdfunded, so we also have a crowdfunding website, a crowdfunding thing. It's on GoFundMe, and it's help us get life-saving medicine approved for COVID.
Okay, so what's going on here seems to me as if there's absolutely, I mean, we're talking about billions even to fund vaccine development, but nothing to fund something which could be a very simple, cheap cure. Why is that?
Yeah, it's because there's no money involved in it. There's no money to be made. The government could be making ivermectin for probably supply the entire country for 500 million or something. And And yeah, and the COVID pharmaceutical industry is worth hundreds of billions. So you can see it's sort of a David and Goliath story, really.
Obviously, you talked about the crowdfunding, but what can individuals do and who should they be targeting? I'm thinking about, you know, possibly these groups like NerveTag and Sage, you know, the government advisors. Are they likely to potentially listen in? And so who should we be directing this information at and getting their attention and sort of, I suppose, tugging their elbows, you know, hey, you know, you need to have a look at this. Who should we be talking to?
I think at this point, I think it has to be, we have to be telling our friends and family and our GPs and our MPs. I think the authorities have taken a position and they're not going to shift without a significant, substantial kind of pressure, because we have been writing to them since early January. We've written to the Medicines Health Regulatory Authorities. We've written to senior politicians. We've written to the Therapeutics Task Force. We've written to the Principal Trial. We've written to the Recovery. We've written to, and they've had the opportunity to include ivermectin in their trial since last year, and that hasn't been done. And the information we get from the MHRA, which is enormously resource intensive, you know, I almost have somebody working for me full time just having to write to these.
These are the regulators that approved the yes. Vaccines,
and,
aren't
and
they?
The information that, you know, I send them the evidence. We send them a body of evidence which has been systematically evaluated according to the highest and most rigorous methods. And they send back to us the fact they say there's not enough evidence. They haven't looked at our evidence. There's not enough evidence. And they refer to a far inferior review that includes just a handful of studies. So it's not it's not a systematic review. It's a systematic review by the first author, Castaneda Sabagal. I'm just absolutely appalled that we can send them the evidence, pages and pages, 100 pages of evidence, and they refer back a review that's a couple of pages and is deeply flawed from a scientific point of view. And they also use a statement put out by Merck. Now, Merck produces ivermectin, but it doesn't get very much money from ivermectin. Merck actually gave away the patent to ivermectin some decades ago when it couldn't realize it couldn't make money from ivermectin because the people suffering from the diseases that ivermectin treats are the poorest of the poor in very poor countries, and so it couldn't make enough money back on it. So in a very humanitarian gesture, gave the patent away, and now ivermectin can be made anyway. But it's ivermectin is competing with the new drugs that Merck is developing. Merck came out with a statement saying that there's no evidence that ivermectin works, and also that there's issues around its safety, which are simply not true. And Merck should know that better than anyone, because they conducted those early safety studies, which show that ivermectin is safe even at 10 times the usual dose. So, but this is the document that the MHRA is using to support its decision not to look further at ivermectin until there's more evidence.
Okay, Tess. Well, look, the $64,000 question is, we've had, well, even today, the total has come down because they think they overestimated it. They reckon around about 90,000 people have died with COVID-19. Is it, how many could you estimate? I know it's a big ask. Could you estimate how many of those people, if there'd been some sort of early intervention, as I understand in some cities around the world, they've actually had vans with ivermectin supplies in them. And when people phone up with the initial shortness of breath and COVID symptoms, those vans will come around and give them ivermectin pills. And not sell them, by the way, give them to them.
Yes.
And how many people do you think may not have died in this pandemic if ivermectin had been available from the start and approved and wasn't competing with these big vaccine manufacturers?
Well, I mean, you know, our estimate was about a 68% reduction. So, you know, we're probably talking around about, I don't know, 60,000 or something. 60 million. 60,000? Sorry, not 60 million. 60,000 people probably. I don't know, you know, and that's what the studies.
But I mean, that's incredible in the whole of the UK, 60,000 people that may still be with us that aren't because of some medical mistakes. I mean, are they mistakes or is this deliberate?
Well, we don't know. The thing is that, you know, it's possible that the government has been oblivious to the fact that ivermectin is a useful treatment, especially when used early on. But I think it's unforgivable going forward. Given the evidence we've provided to them, for them to continue to take that position. And I think, you know, we certainly need to, and what I've been trying to do for the last 3 months, is to communicate the fact that the people dying every day do not need to be doing so, because we have ivermectin, and if used very early, it has a great chance of averting deaths due to COVID.
Now, I know the World Health Organization came out with a statement just recently about ivermectin. Was it good or bad?
Yes, the World Health Organization's position is that ivermectin is not to be used unless in a clinical trial. Now, this is really a mystery to me, given the huge body of evidence available, but less of a mystery when I look at the evidence that they've evaluated to support that recommendation, because they've only included a selection of the studies of the randomized controlled trials on ivermectin. So they've looked at a very, very narrow focus of studies, and even within their evidence, they've shown 81% reduction in deaths. So they've looked at a select number of studies, they get an 81% reduction in deaths, but they have interpreted that evidence as being insufficient. So I find this totally unacceptable. And as a group, we are putting together a rebuttal to make an inquiry as to how they have come to that conclusion. The other thing in their analysis is. That they also mention safety issues. Now, they know better than anyone that ivermectin is extremely safe because they have said so in many of their documents, particularly their documents on scabies. In 2018, they talk about it being very safe, especially in immunocompromised individuals. And they also refer to the fact that it's been given so widely amongst, you know, in billions of doses. So, and that was one of the reasons why it got added to the World Health Organization Essential Medicine List in 2019 or 2018. So it's really surprising to see them suggesting that there are safety concerns, especially when in their analysis, from the randomized controlled trial evidence, there were so few adverse events that there was no difference between the control group and the ivermectin group.
Well, I mean, I've noticed over the last few years, I know the World Health Organization used just to be an office of the United Nations. It now seems to be anybody that wants to can help fund it, and obviously that they will be playing a role in it. We've got the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation funding it. We've got the Chinese Communist Party, the Chinese government funding it. How actually independent is it? Because something, a body like this in charge of policy for world health really does need to be fiercely independent. But I'm not convinced it is, particularly with foundations funding it rather than governments, and no proper oversight. So how independent is the World Health Organization, and who overlooks it to make sure that anything that goes wrong is corrected pronto?
Well, Tony, I think that's the question everybody's wondering these days. So I don't really have an answer for you. It seems like it, I don't think there's anybody watching the World Health Organization. They seem to just, they seem to be in charge, and they seem to have a huge influence on country health policy. So, yeah.
Yeah, because we can't have something without any kind of oversight, especially when they have a very powerful view, a very powerful role as an international policymaker. I mean, for example, it was them that declared the pandemic. You know, there's all sorts of things, the WHO, and we need to trust them. Is there anything you think that we can do in order to either get rid of untoward influences from the WHO, or to make sure that it's a little bit more accountable to the public around the world?
Well, I've actually just established a company called EBMC Squared, and this is a community interest company that it's a not-for-profit. Any profit the company makes goes back into the company, and we're expanding our workforce, and our intention is to conduct research that measures, checks and balances on what's actually going on an international level, and will insist on more accountability from the authorities, because it seems like the authorities at the moment are not reflecting necessarily what's in the public best interest. So I think I'm really just, like everyone else, a member of the public, often just feeling like the authorities do not, do not support my point of view, or understand my perspective or views and experiences. So, I think many people at the moment feel similarly. And it seems like the authorities themselves are all in agreement. You know, the European Medicine Agency comes up with the same statements about ivermectin, for example, as the World Health Organization, and the National Institute of Health in America comes up with the same statements, and so does the Philippine health authorities and the South African health authorities. So they all seem to be in agreement, for example, on the ivermectin issue for COVID, and yet there's as a researcher, I see that there are serious flaws in all the evidence that they're using, and they're all using different bits of evidence. So for example, one country will use two studies, another country will use five studies, WHO will use seven studies for their evidence synthesis. And they all come up with a statement saying there's insufficient evidence and we have safety concerns. So it's just very concerning that there's this lack of rigor with regard to evidence evaluation, and that there is this these sorts of similarities in that both the lack of rigor and the statements that are then produced.
Yeah, I mean, I've noticed this whole thing about build back better. There seems to be the similar phrases even being used by leaders around the world. You've talked about the authorities here in the UK either not listening or turning a deaf ear to the evidence you've presented them. How do you think that the mass media have got on? Because they're normally like, if there's a problem, with the regulators or the authorities, it's the mass media's job to pick up on that, make a bit of a fuss and a scandal, and at least draw the public's attention to it, maybe to get something done. So how have you found the media?
Well, it seems like the media is more interested in Meghan Markle it just seems like whenever, for example, when all the issues around the royal family were being highlighted in the press, I was trying to get the message out about this life-saving treatment, and I could not get a single reporter. We've put press releases out. We've contacted offices of The Guardian, The Independent, or The Daily Mail. We just have not been able to get anyone interested in a life-saving treatment for COVID. It is absolutely bizarre.
Well, I wonder if, maybe these journalists and editors have been got at. I mean, surely if there's an interesting story like that, they pick it up, unless they've had some previous information to the contrary, you'd have thought.
Yes. Well, I think there's been, so I think they have been targeted as, with misinformation. I mean, if you Google ivermectin, you'll get a whole lot of nonsense about ivermectin, including what's on Wikipedia. So, so I think that possibly they're equally challenged. There are journalists trying to, not in this country necessarily, but there are some good journalists around the world really who see what's happening and who are trying to be heard. But our platforms, their platforms are being closed down. So on YouTube, for example, I've been so censored on YouTube, and I'm a medical doctor trying to get scientific information out to public and doctors, and I've had my videos taken down off YouTube.
YouTube tell you why they've taken it down, or they just say?
And the YouTube thing, it says you're not allowed to publish anything about ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine for COVID, otherwise your post will be removed. So I've had that clarified for me. That basically there are some posts that stay up. For example, I was interviewed by John Campbell a month ago. And I've had many interviews over the past couple of months, and several of them are still up. And John Campbell's interview has had almost 200,000 views, which is good news. But for example, the message that I put out to the Prime Minister on the 6th of January, that's been removed from my YouTube channel. And
so can we still find that anywhere? Because I'd like to put
it is up. It's on Paul Marrick put it up. Professor Paul Marrick put it on his channel. And I think you might find it on the FLCCC channel.
Going forward, I understand you're bringing some medical practitioners together. What's the point of that exactly? And when is that happening?
We have a medical conference on ivermectin, the first ever medical conference on ivermectin, happening in 2 weeks' time. Well, actually, not this weekend, next weekend. And we have eight speakers. We've got Dr. Mobeen Syed, we've got Professor Pierre Corey, Professor Hector Cavallo, Dr. Wasif Khan, a number of other doctors who will be speaking about their experiences using ivermectin and also hearing the evidence on ivermectin and also the ethics around using and not using ivermectin at this stage in the pandemic. So
that's the 24th and the 25th of April.
Yes.
Are you hoping that there will be some sort of change in policy? Because I can hear listeners listening to this thinking, well, at the very least, I'd like to have a few of these tablets in my medicine cupboard to pop them if I needed them, or give them to an elderly loved one. Is that a feasible thing to do?
Well, that's the beauty of ivermectin, with it being so safe and widely used, and we know that countries are distributing it widely to their populations, that it is the sort of thing. In this country with such a great postal service, the government could post it to everybody and say, use this if you're in contact with somebody with COVID, or if you feel unwell, you can take it. And it is something that they could take that sort of policy, or they might decide you go and get it from the pharmacy if you need it, and have some basic questions. So, I would really hope to see that that's the type of approach that they take, and the sooner the better.
You've exposed, I think, quite a serious flaw in the way that medical policy is decided in Britain. Is there anything that you could say that you think might fix that, other than sacking Sage, the government advisors and these people. Obviously, some new blood might help things. But is there anything you could say to make it so that when the next pandemic, God forbid, comes along, that we stand a chance of actually getting the correct treatments for it?
Yeah, I think what has to happen is there has to be independent, objective evaluation, and the conflicts of interest of members of any of these panels, even university academics, need to be very closely examined and should be, and they should be really separate from the pharmaceutical industry.
So the pharmaceutical industry has been, are we talking here about the old revolving door syndrome where they're coming in and out of government?
I don't know, but if you do look at the conflicts of interest, declarations of interest of members of all of these, and even, you know, the politicians and all that, you know, it just seems like it needs to be absolutely clear what the conflicts of interest are, who is getting unlimited funds from what pharmaceutical company, and even a research fund, for example, or even from a charitable organisation. There are charitable organisations that fund Oxford University, for example, to a huge extent, and other universities and individuals with unlimited research grants. So I think one needs to really, going forward and almost immediately, we need to be looking at the money. Yeah.
Follow the money. Tess, if you could just wind up with giving us email... a website or whatever to look at to follow your work?
Yes, we are putting up a new website for EBMC Square, the community interest company. But for the moment, you will find everything you need on e-bmc, so it's e-bmc.co.uk. And on that, you will find a template for a letter to your GP and a letter to your MP. And there's frequently asked questions. There's the Bird Proceedings document, which is a 100-page document with all the evidence. We are in the process of updating the review because there have been some new studies on ivermectin published, and we'll be adding those data to the existing data and presenting those at the conference next week.
Dr. Tess Lawrence from Evidence Based Medical Consultancy, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.